You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
To our third episode, looking back at the second RTD era. Last time we got up to 73 yards, and we'll be picking up today with the second half of season one and also the special Joy to the World. My name's Mansour. I'm joined again by Mark to run through these.
Hello.
And should we jump straight in? Oh, and we'll also do a little bit of looking forward to season two at the end, if we get time. Right, so second half of season one starts off with Dot and Bubble. This was definitely one of my favourites of the season. Where did it rank for you?
Very highly, yeah. I'd say this and 73 Yards and Boom are kind of the top ranking ones for me. Well, and Joy to the World when we get there. In terms of the overall like main season, this is sort of in the kind of top three, really.
Yeah, definitely. Same for me. It's like a lot of Doctor Who, you can see its roots in other things, and I think Russell T. Davis spoke quite explicitly about Black Mirror. I'm trying to think back to my interviews and things that he did at the time. But yeah, you can see its connection to other stuff. But also, like, you know, just even down to the monster designs and things, there's a lot of like very Doctor Who feel to it. So it feels like it's part of this world. It doesn't just feel like a ripoff of like other stuff. Do you think it was unfortunate that we had so many Dr. Light episodes in such a short run when it was shooting out was first season, but they made the best of this one? I think we might have said before that the Doctor and Ruby might not have been, the actors might not have been pulled in for as many filming days, but they feel very present because they're always popping up on these screens during the episode. What do you think? What is it about this that made it sort of further up the rankings for both of us?
I think it's the central conceit and how it's delivered. I had a bit of an interesting sort of experience of this one because I had heard sometime ahead of the season starting, and this is something I occasionally, you know, I have no one to blame except myself on this front, but occasionally a spoiler will be put in front of me and I can't resist. And then in this particular instance, it came via another podcast, which has a pretty good track record of, not a perfect track record, but a pretty good track record of being quite close to the grapevine and revealing things in advance. And so at my own risk, I listened to this thing and they said that this episode would feature... What I'd heard was that via this podcast was that the story would involve the Doctor arriving back in a colony he'd originally been to as the second Doctor, and they remembered him having saved them. He was a very celebrated character, and that he would end up in a situation where he was helping them out, but from a remote location where they couldn't see him, and he was sort of talking them through the crisis, and then what would happen at the end would be he would be revealed to them as you know, the now black presenting to, well, the black doctor that he now is, and their racism would suddenly be revealed in this moment, and they would become hostile to him. So you can see that that wasn't too far wide of the mark in terms of what was ultimately broadcast. It's now, because I'd heard that, it meant that when it came to watching it, even when I saw the next time trailer for it, I could see the sea of white faces, and I thought, that rumor, that inside information was correct. But it also meant that I never got to put myself to the test, insofar as I don't know, had I not heard, at what point I would have noticed that it was an entirely white colony. It's an interesting one because they have some interesting, you know, you're so focused, I think, on the dynamics of the character and the tensions in the situation and the eccentricities of this sort of social media world, that you're not necessarily thinking about who looks a certain way, apart from the fact that they're all wearing pastel colors or whatever it is. You know, so yeah, I will never know at what point, if at all, I would have twigged what was going on there. There are some subtle tells all the way through, you know, things that Lindy says to and about the doctor, which...
Yeah, when you rewatch it.
Yeah, when you rewatch it, you certainly spot them a lot more. You know, they jump out at you, whereas on first watch, they just hit you with a kind of a... They hit the ear slightly wrong, maybe, but you don't quite fully consciously process it, and it's quite clever in that respect. You know, some of the things she says, for instance, you know, how did you get in here, or you know, is this something to do with you when stuff starts going wrong? You know, those kind of little comments and stuff about, oh, I can't wait until you're disciplined afterwards. And but that, you know, until you really get to that moment of reveal, it's not very clear what that's all about, other than just her being petulant, you know, because she could come across that way anyway. She's quite a sort of bratty character, really. Anyway.
And some of it's quite subtle facial expressions as well, like the first time he pops up and she dismisses or blocks or swipes him away, there's this slight, you know, what you think is just a sort of petulant look of annoyance of like, oh, who's this person who's bothering me, that, you know, he's made that cold call. But then in hindsight, that look of disgust takes on, well, yeah, it comes across to me more as a look of disgust rather than annoyance when she just does this like little sort of grimace as she's swiping the doctor's screen away. Mm. And yeah, there's loads of little things like that. And it gets less subtle as it goes on closer to the reveal, like right at the end when they're talking about voodoo and all of that just before the twist. But I think it's one of those twists that doesn't... Because there's certain types of twist where on a rewatch, it sort of saps the excitement out of it, because it's like, oh, yeah, I know what's going to happen here. But this is one of those examples where rewatching it is actually quite rewarding, because you're picking up on these things and seeing it in a different way and almost watching a different episode with that knowledge of what's coming at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing about this one is, you know, that's a heck of a first day in the office for Judy, isn't it, to come in and his first scene be that one where it is that culminating scene where he fully processes what's going on and has that incredible reaction to it. It's very powerful. It's hugely uncomfortable. And it's... you know, he's amazing in that scene, but it was a heck of an ask for him to come in on day one and just, right, this is what you're doing. Yeah, so that was a baptism of fire right there.
And I don't want to sort of, like, just make sort of unfavorable comparisons to the Chibnall era, but I think the fact that you have a black doctor, the fact that you're doing something with that and acknowledging it and doing a story like this. I know Jodie's era had bits of that, like in The Witchfinders and other stories, like gender is mentioned, but most of the time it's sort of brushed off, and maybe that's right to like get on with telling a story, but I would have liked a bit more of that in 13th Doctor Zero. Like, what does it mean to be a woman in history, and what does that sometimes mean?
And another interesting dimension to think about that, you know, adjacent to all of that is, say it had, you know, maybe it's in my mind more because I was originally set up to expect that, you know, they had this sort of historical memory of the, you know, a white doctor, you know, like Patrick Troughton or somebody having come and saved the colony before. But if you think about it, like, there could be any number of those sorts of colonies that we saw in particularly the 60s or whatever, the Macro Terror or something like that, where a white-faced doctor shows up to a, you know, a pretty much white cast, you know, and then they happily resolve things. He's waved off with a cheery goodbye and all. And you might, one or two of those colonies may have shared, you know, these racist values. We just don't know, and the doctor would never have known. And it's unsettling to think, do you know what I mean? That characters, maybe guest characters we grew to like or enjoy in that particular adventure, could have held these sort of, you know, it could have been a widely spread belief amongst their people, but it just never came up in the story. And so this really puts that front and center and sort of makes you think about that kind of, I mean, hopefully there aren't too many colonies like that in the far future, because it's a bit dispiriting. But I guess it's one of those lessons of history that if you're not careful. Oh, and that's one thing, because one of those things that RTD likes to do is to present you with a thing and say, look, I'm not saying that this is a negative. It's actually maybe a real positive for the future. Like, for instance, in this case, it's the 2-hour working week. And that 2-hour working week frees up so much. I think it's a logical path of progression that society will eventually get to something like that, because there'll be more and more technological assistance and things, and so people will only work for less and less time in the future. But the point I'm making, I suppose, is what he's saying is he's not inclined to be negative about these things. Like, he wouldn't sort of wag his finger about people watching too much television. He sees the virtue of the public discourse in television and things like that. Here, the equivalent of that is to say, look, the 2-hour working week is a potentially very positive thing, but it's a double-edged sword, because as much as it frees up time for creativity and hobbies and all the rest of it, and you know, meaningful social engagement, it also maybe presents a time in which conspiracy theories and paranoia can fester, and you need to be really careful about what you do with your time in this world of you know, potential almost full-time leisure. Do you know what I mean? It's like, don't fill your time with prejudice. I guess it's kind of one of those lessons for the future, you know, well ahead of that envisaged future, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, that's interesting about the 2-hour working day, because I didn't take it that way. I took it more as, because I felt you never get an impression that they're doing anything useful. Because I feel like if you were doing like a story that's set in the future where they have it, like employment law and practices advanced to the point where you can do a useful day's work in 2 hours, you'd be doing like two quite intense hours of high value work. But it feels like these people are just like sat at desks doing busy work, or sort of ambiguous busy work, for a couple of hours. That's because they're on their dot and bubble while they're doing that work as well, aren't they? So
that's true. Yeah. So
I never got the feeling that they were like going in and doing this, you know, sort of intensive, high value 2 hours of work. But yeah,
that's a good point
about the downtime that it creates as well. And so let's talk about, before we move on, I think we should talk about Lindsay Pepperbean, though, like this central character who, with it being Doctor and Companion Light, who's our main focus for most of the episode. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there with subverting this, that sort of, when it starts off, you expect that trope of, here's this person who's, you know, being taken on this like heroic journey to move from someone who's quite passive and stuck, and then starts to take on traits of the Doctor and becomes more active and becomes a hero. And then there's a complete subversion or rug pull around that. Well, I guess it's with Rookie September, isn't it? Like that's, is that the moment, or is that's a turning point?
Yeah, I mean, that's the moment where when he's first introduced, he's sort of, I think you're absolutely right, it sort of leans in momentarily into that trope of, oh, he's going to open her eyes to these other possibilities of how he can see the world and all that.
He's a surrogate doctor, basically.
And of course, we don't know how far his individualism extended in the end. Was he the only non-racist on the planet? And probably not, actually. He was probably just, in that respect, as bad as the rest of them, but just a bit more of an individualist in terms of what he did with his time. I have to be careful how I put this, because obviously her views turn out to be reprehensible, like the rest of them, and she becomes very unlikable for that reason. But I did think, okay, as far as I can, this was in the early stages of the episode, as far as, you know, even though I could see she was petulant and kind of snappy and all these things, there was nevertheless something like likably kind of quirky about her, and I just I kind of hoped for her that she would go on that journey you're talking about, and I do wonder that there's, I'm thinking back, for instance, to a character like Novice Haim, who, you know, comes back having been on a sort of an unseen redemptive arc in the meantime, when the Doctor reconnects and a previous villain has become somebody reformed or you know, considerably more matured in terms of how they see the world and how much they want to help. And I wonder, is there a potential redemptive path and even a possible return on the cards for somebody like Lindy? Now, she does have, you know, when they part company at the end there and she gives him that very cold, just narcissistically cool stare from the boat, and they make eye contact, there doesn't seem to be any prospect of that.
But I was wondering about that this time, actually, because I might be imagining it, but I was imagining, like, just in her expression, just a little bit of regret, a little bit of doubt, the way she's looking back. Like, obviously on the surface there's disdain and disgust, but the way that, like, why doesn't he just, if she was so, like, steeped in those racist attitudes that she had, like, zero regard for the Doctor, would she have said thank you? Like, and would she have held his gaze? Wouldn't she have just, like, turned away and just started talking to her friends about where they were going?
Yeah, I guess there is a sort of a bit of an ambiguity to some of that, but it does. I mean, oddly enough, I had the reverse this time. Having seen a bit more of what you're talking about first time round, I think I looked at it this time and thought it just felt a bit harder, you know? It just felt a bit less leaning towards the possibility of redemption. And it was just, it was almost a look of just narcissistic defiance. And that conceding of the thank you was nearly a point of social etiquette, in the same way as, you know, back in the day, somebody might have talked to the household help with a sort of surface thank you, but absolutely still this sort of two-tier.
Yeah, like a grudging thank you, because she's intelligent enough to be aware that he has probably helped to save her life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like only with that sort of extraordinary circumstance where she can bring herself to, yeah, and talk to him face to face.
Yeah, it's very much a, I suppose I'd better thank you kind of thing, you know, rather than that's as close as she can get. But then, of course, she is being witnessed by her peers there, and so possibly, it's an interesting one. Just one thing while it's in my head before we move on, because it could be easily overlooked, a small production thing here. The set design I thought was clever, because the way they've done it, that they have these sort of like very quite relatively nondescript like walls and things. So as she's walking around, as she's being guided around and trying to walk unaided for the first time without the aid of the bubble, you see these walls, and it's like just literally like a two-tone thing, beige at the bottom or whatever, and a primary color like a blue or a green or something at the top. And it's really there, just it's all just about something to impinge upon your peripheral awareness and say, you know, okay, if the wall's orange, I'm on level two or whatever, you know what I mean? You don't have to think about it. But there's certainly no, you know, there's nothing more finessed than that. There would be no wall art or anything. You know, it's not a world that needs that, because it's just purely about these people that live inside the bubble 97% of the time. And
no one's going to see sculptures or...
So I like that. I like that thing, which I only really took on board this time watching it. You know, little set choices and things really lean into that whole world. Anyway.
We could probably say lots more about that episode, but let's move on to Rogue. And this is one that I would say was an episode I enjoyed. Like, I place it well above Space Babies in terms of rankings. It was great to see Indira Varma back as a villain. And it was cool to see the Doctor having a romantic relationship that's not a heterosexual one, and that just being played in the same way as it was in Girl in the Fireplace, and just not made a big thing of. Beyond that, though, and I was really surprised with this one, because this one had a guest writer, I think, but maybe out of, well, maybe this and Space Babies, maybe the finale as well, like these were the episodes that felt the most like a bit of a rerun of what we'd had before. And that surprised me with this one in particular, having a guest writer, that this felt like a lot of the stuff we'd seen before in the first RTD era. So my feeling was, decent episode, not a bad one, but it's never going to be at the top of my list. There's nothing that makes it like really extraordinary or like stand out for me. It's just very solid. What were your impressions of this one?
Similar. It's one of those things where, in terms, there's some clever stuff going on in it. I think it might have been a 7 out of 10-ish type of episode for me, were it not for the fact that that kind of charismatic pairing up of the Doctor and Rogue really pulls like the spotlight. Like it's so well done. There's just this real it's interesting, because I've heard one or two other podcasts suggest there was no chemistry between them, and I'm thinking, are you blind? Because it's there in spades as far as I can see. You know, that moment where they dance and the lights come down and everything, that's actually, in some ways, it's one of the episodes that most subtly, because it's sort of doing so much, and you're sort of steeped in this world of Bridgerton and everything, you can almost, without thinking about it, fail to notice that here again are these sort of like meta, I mean, obviously Bridgerton is a very meta thing to throw in there, and the cosplay idea and everything, cosplaying history, but like the fact that, you know, you're watching something that's either metaphor or actuality in terms of the lights coming right down and those two being in the center of the dance floor. And if we are, you know, and I know we'll talk about it, I'm sure, towards the end again, if there's still a possibility that the meta thing could be in the mix, there's something quite interesting. I think just there's some beautiful visuals in this. I think all that stuff, you know, where they shoot outside in the moonlight and the little TARDIS park next to the big tree, and you've got the giant spaceship. I love just in terms of a sort of a mood, I really like it. I was a bit less enamored of the Childra themselves in terms of just like, I don't know, it's quite broad, isn't it? But then it's fun too. So, you know, it's and then the business at the end with the the Triforce. Oh, this is, of course, this has to be mentioned when the Triforce is first introduced and the Doctor is trying to get out of that situation after he's been dancing to Kylie Minogue and all the rest of it. We have the iconic Richard E. Grant appear, and you know, that was a
that was an interesting moment. That was one of the most notable bits for me.
Yeah.
This episode.
It's either just playfulness, or again, they're suggesting something of the, you know, the expanded universe, the Doctor Who multiverse, or something. It could be just toying with the fans a little bit. It could just be having a bit of fun.
I think this was just
feeding things in.
Yeah, I think this was just a musical choice. But like, another thing you could add to that meta list is that thing about using modern songs but doing them in a like a period style, like some of the music during the dance scenes. I can't remember which songs it were, but
we had Lady Gaga towards the end, didn't we? And correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not an expert, but Bridgerton itself does that, doesn't it? It takes
so probably a reference to that. Yeah. But no, I agree about Rogue and the chemistry. I could easily, you know, I'm not. It's another question about whether the actor would be available, but I could easily see the character Rogue being this semi-regular River type character, over the next few years coming back. And because it felt to me like it was, he disappears at the end, but it felt like it was almost being set up for a return, or the possibility of a return.
Yeah, like the new Captain Jack almost.
It didn't feel, there was a lot of Captain Jack in him as well, but kind of mixed between Jack and River, possibly. Obviously, it's not a historical figure, but it didn't feel as like final and tragic as Girl in the Fireplace, where this is a finite thing and the tragedy is that she's died and she's gone. This felt just more like they've been separated, possibly temporarily.
Yeah, he throws out that find me challenge to him at the end. And even though the Doctor does say, look, you know, there are as many parallel dimensions as grains of sand in the universe, sort of thing. If the writers have seen the potential for more there, and they will have done, that is on the cards, you know.
Jumping ahead to season two, but like our finale for season two is called The Reality War.
There you go. So that somebody could step through in the right circumstances. That's right. I thought it's just one of those ones you can really steep yourself into the atmosphere of, and it kind of hits the Doctor quite because emotionally hard at the end. You know, he is affected by it in a way. You know, it's good that Ruby makes him stop at the end and have that hug, because he's ready to rattle on to the next thing, which is him almost reverting back to old habits and forgetting about, you know, being the post-therapy Doctor there for a minute. She has to pull him back into that that mode, his more sort of self-aware mode.
I think that's an interesting thing, actually. Like, maybe, like, with this whole retrospective that we've done, we went into this era with that notion of, this is the Doctor who's gone through therapy, that's why he's in touch with his emotions. It's not entirely consistent. There are moments where there's a lot of that old sort of repression or difficulty of dealing with emotions that is still there. He's not a completely different character. Maybe this is one of those moments that shows that he does sometimes react in the way that he would have done in previous incarnations. So I was just bringing up the season two titles, but maybe we can come on to those once we've gotten through the remaining episodes. But shall we move on to our two-part finale for this
season? Yes, let's do that.
Now, I didn't have time to rewatch both of these, but I rewatched Empire of Death, and just a little structural thing that I felt at the time, I think, is it almost feels like the episode break comes 15 minutes into Empire of Death, because that's the big time jump when, you know, time's moved on and we pick things up again. And that felt very much like the space between, like a Moffat two-parter, where you'd have like a big universe changing thing in the penultimate episode, jump a few months forward and then pick up in the finale. So this, I felt like this, maybe it was just to do with running times, but the structure of this two-parter was a bit off for me. And I'll very, very briefly sort of mention sort of my feelings, because I think they're quite common ones, and then I'll hand over to you, because I think you felt more positively than some about these episodes. But there was lots to like. There were some really lovely moments with, like, Mel in the Memory TARDIS, just having Mel as a companion for these two episodes. It looked really good in places. There were some really exciting action sequences. And there were some interesting ideas about, you know, Ruby's mother is significant because we thought she was significant. Again, tying to that meta thing of it's almost us as the audience watching Doctor Who and assuming that Ruby's mum is special, which makes her special. That was an interesting idea. I wasn't super sold on the execution, and it's just like, it's things like when I watched Church on Ruby Road, and you see that hooded figure. In retrospect, that falls a bit flat for me, because it's just her mum, and she's pointing menacingly towards a street sign for some reason, rather than just like leaving a note saying, you know, this is Ruby. But yeah, so that's my feeling, and I think this retrospective has been really good for like reminding me of how much good stuff there was in this season. I think because I was a bit down on this ending, that like had this effect of like slightly souring me on the whole season and leaving me with an impression that was worse than it deserved. So basically this didn't work for me as well as it could have done. I think a lot of other people felt similar, but I'll hand over to you, Mark, because I think you found more to enjoy in this one.
Yeah, I went on a bit of a strange journey with this one, because I understand something of what you're talking about there, because I had been going on this. To me, the season went on this very strong run, certainly from episode two through to right up until and including Rogue. And then I was all ready for, and I understand that I'm, you know, partly to blame for this, because I brought my baggage of expectations to what the finale would and should even be, you know, in terms of all this meta theorizing that had crept into the mix. And then, you know, the Legend of Ruby Sunday initially disappointed the heck out of me, because I watched it and I thought, oh no, like, certainly when that ending arrived, I thought, surely it's not just bringing back an old villain. Is it just bringing back an old villain? And then it was exactly that. And it was, it fell, you know, that moment of reveal fell and actually still largely falls totally flat for me for two reasons, right? One, I think the way it's executed is very overdone. Now not the build up through the episode itself, which is actually pretty strong. But the moment of its reveal, do you remember how in Aliens of London they had that first sort of cliffhanger around the Slitheen? Yeah, and because they hadn't done cliffhangers for years, it felt a bit too spun out. It lost its own momentum. It wasn't concise enough, and it didn't. And because of that, it just sort of overtoppled a bit. This felt like that to me, and I thought, oh, even with all those intervening years, it's still, they've done that again, you know. Sutext, you know, if it had been like like the end of Fenric, you know, at Fenric part three or whatever, where it's like we play the contest again time, you know, that kind of really concise punchy moment, and you go flipping heck. But it was this, you know, don't get me wrong, the Harriet Arbinger stuff and all, great, the sort of talking, the kind of her talking in that that kind of mantra and everything, and then even the anagram thing. But then Susan Twist stands there for ages, talking and talking and talking, and everybody is wide-eyed. And I don't know, it felt really stretched.
It's even more than Utopia levels of hype, and I think Utopia works so well because it's built up just enough in the season. Derek Jacobi is so good. And the Master has so much personal significance to the Doctor, who thinks that he's the last survivor of a genocide that he committed. Yeah. All of that makes it so impactful. And then, and this one, yeah, Sutekh's a well-regarded villain, but it's a long time ago. He's not really like, however much you retrospectively talk him up, he doesn't really feel like a recurring nemesis of the Doctor. It's like one TV story and a few bits of spin-off media.
And then the other thing, by the way, I realize I'm sounding quite negative here, but I am going to spin this around in a minute. The second dimension to that really disappointed me was, well, just the fact that it was Sutekh. You know, it's just like, to me, now I have to admit, and I know that I'm unusual in this as a fan, right? One of my least favorite stories is Pyramids of Mars. I don't know why, it just doesn't hit me the same way. Like, I think in some ways it's so, like, this is what Doctor Who should be to a certain generation of fans, that it almost repels me with its sort of, like, you know, template or totemic nature or something. You know, it's just like, okay. And then you've got Sutekh, who, don't get me wrong, like, Gabriel Wolf has an amazing voice, and he invests that character with so much surface sort of, I don't know what the word would be, like, he really draws you in with that voice, and he's scary. But there isn't really much to Sutekh. He's this godlike being, and by the time we reach the end of this season, he's somebody that's sort of built himself up to a point where he's close to omnipotence, and he has a sort of obsession with acquiring total omnipotence, which is why Ruby's mother is the one missing link of the chain for him. But I don't know, just at that moment I was so hugely disappointed that it was just like, oh, we've put a Sutekh in it, you know, that it just left me really disappointed that week. Empire of Death came along, right? Yeah. And totally redeemed it for me, because now I know I'm unusual in this regard, because most people out there seem to be saying, oh, the first part was the one that worked amazingly well, and it was the second one that let everything down. I personally feel it's the opposite. I think what Russell T. Davis did was intentionally bring back a villain that he knew a certain proportion of the fandom would love to see again, right? And he says, well, look, okay, I've done the Ian Levine thing now, right? I've done it on purpose, and I've given you this. Now be careful what you wish for, because he's actually a great big god of nothing, right? And then overtly says so, and then dispatches him in a manner which, you know, had a lot of fans wailing and gnashing their teeth. But I think actually was brilliant, because what he's saying is, okay, there he is. He's a device. He's brought about this catastrophic end of the universe thing. Now what is he? Like, he's just a big dog with a scary voice. What do we do? How do we bring this back to the soul of what Doctor Who is? And the way you do that is you say, it's kind of in the way that the Daleks were sort of summarily dismissed by Rose at the end of The Parting of the Ways. You say, right, you are a great big god of nothing, and all that's really important here is the foregrounding of the emotional journey of our main characters. And there's a moment, there are some beautiful moments in this. The real heart of this for me, right? There are two key things that have both the soul of this story, what's important in this story, and the soul of Doctor Who. And I've seldom seen the essence of Doctor Who captured better than in these moments. And I'll try and explain as concisely as I can what I mean. One of them is the moment where the Doctor goes in to the wasteland, into that tent, and talks to that lady. And
that was a really good scene, though.
It's so beautifully done. Yeah, it's so the kindness in his eyes, and the way she's so exhausted, and she talks very, you know, with this sort of residual sense of romance about the place, but it's all fading, it's all going. And he is so gentle with the way he approaches it. he asks about the deceased baby. She isn't quite even aware that she's lost the child. She has some sort of vague awareness at the end. And when she hands over the spoon, this is the crucial thing for me. Now, I know some people find this very stupid. They were like, this is ridiculous. What is it he's after, a spoon? But they're sort of throwing away the poetry of that moment for just plot literalism, you know? And I think what that scene gives us is just like this amazing distillation of the Doctor, where he holds his spoon aloft and he says, with this spoon, I might save the universe, right? And then by the time that scene has ended and that lady is deceased, he actually changes. It has changed from I might to I swear, right? Now, he doesn't mean literally the spoon and only the spoon, but there's something in that that boils down the essence of the Doctor to, like, what is he? He's a very silly man who can do the most profound and hope-giving things by virtue of the sheer silliness, you know? And do you know what I mean? Like, he takes the most improbable thing there and he gives you hope and he you believe him, you know? And I think that's Doctor Who in a nutshell. I've never seen a scene. I've seen very few scenes in the series history. And what's crazy is Russell T. Davis said on the commentary, you'll probably remember this, that they were going to cut that out. That whole scene was going to go. And I like that's unbelievable to me, like that they would have sacrificed that on the altar of having some more stuff in the the Westminster.
I think the best
part of
that final episode for me.
The other thing I was talking about that I think encapsulates the spirit and the heart of Doctor Who in this story is a lot of people were complaining afterwards about how much time was spent in the memory TARDIS and even saying it was embarrassing and just, you know, they had all that Disney money and look what they've done. They've taken it down into this. They've set one third of this finale in this cramped little cluttered space. And to me, what that's saying is that's RTD having really good instincts and going, yes, we have all this Disney money now, right? We have, it's brilliant that we have it and we can and should be doing amazing things we've never been able to do before with this. But let's remember what Doctor Who has. It has a BBC heart. It's BBC to its core, right? And what is this might sound like a strange thing to bring in at this moment, but what is more BBC, right? The BBC we grew up with, you and I. I'm a bit older than you, but you'll know what I'm talking about. Than the likes of, you know, the broom cupboard, for instance, right? The memory TARDIS is the broom cupboard. It's this intimate space. It's the counterintuitive move of, yes, we're this big institution, but come and join us behind the water pipes in this little silly cupboard and we'll you'll feel like our friends every afternoon. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of drawing you into an intimate space in a way that no amount of grandstanding with money could ever do. And I think that all those little touchstones, it's not just Mel caressing the Sixth Doctor's coat or holding the Seventh Doctor's question mark. I know all those lovely kisses to the past are there, but it's just bringing the scale back down, pulling you in and giving you hope in this little warm ember of sanctuary in the middle of this devastated universe. And from there, giving the Doctor just this little breathing space to find his way back to his best self. And I just I'm not talking about it as articulately as I wanted to, but you know what I mean about that? There's something like, it's the spirit of the broom cupboard, it's the spirit of Lime Grove. It's small, it's intimate, and it's going, Doctor Who is still this.
Yeah,
it hasn't forgotten what it is, and it's still here. And please see that we see that, and please see that that's the heart of it. And then at the very end, you get all that stuff about Ruby's mother, the scene in the coffee shop. And I think it's fantastic. I would happily watch 10 more scenes of that than I like that than I would of just Sutek saying villainy things while the Doctor does witty retorts. You know, you need that stuff too. But I think they got the proportions exactly right. And I think they just there's a bit in I was this is again another odd thing to bring in at this moment. But I was watching a bit of season 17 the other night, of all things. And I hadn't seen it in years, but Creature from the Pit. And the doctor, Tom Baker, just throws out this very flippant comment. I had a couple of things that guy didn't have, which was a teaspoon and an open mind. And that phrase, you know, there's the doctor holding the spoon aloft. You know, that's kind of nearly like the...
Yeah, I was just thinking of that phrase when you mentioned what you were talking
about. Yeah, there he is with his teaspoon and open mind. And it's the only way back to the universe in that moment. It's like it makes, you know, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it. And so, yeah, I don't know. So I've seen all this stuff in it that apparently other people aren't seeing. Maybe I'm over romanticizing it. I see it.
Definitely, like the stuff with the scene with the spoon, I definitely see that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why that I liked that part of the episode. Like, I liked lots of parts of this episode's, or this two-part finale, including like the stuff with Ruby's mother. I think that was played really nicely. There are little things like where, you know, the barista's called Ruby's order and she's said, yeah, that's me, and then just ignored the barista to have the conversation with her mum. Little things like that. But no, it's played with like a lot of like really affecting emotion. The one last thing that didn't work as well for me was the departure at the end, and it felt like something that was designed to come at the end of a longer run of time with Ruby and the Doctor, like, because we've had 8 episodes, 2 of which are we haven't had both of them like heavily featured, so 6 episodes plus a Christmas special. And it felt like it was really going for it with like that sort of Rose and the Doctor parting ways in Doomsday sort of energy. And again, both the actors played it really, really well. The scene in isolation was great. It's just I didn't feel like there had been enough build up over the previous episodes to warrant that level of focus on it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and yet when I watched it, and every time I've watched that scene so far, the fact that it hits me, like, it does affect me emotionally. Like, I get it, you know, I get the feels, as they say, you know, every time, and deeply. And I mean, the doctor's little tight smile at the end there, like he's with, it's kind of like a little echo of when Sarah leaves at the end of Hand of Fear or something like that. You know, he's holding it in, but he's not really holding it in. He's slightly better at showing, but he's still, you know, it again, there we are, there's a double-edged sword of post-therapy, but not still not brilliant at some aspects of that. But you know, there's yeah, I can just looking at it from a production standpoint, I suspect what happened is that you're right. It was intended to be a longer run. I think how things hit the news headlines got a bit garbled. There probably was an honest conversation between Millie Gibson and the production team where she maybe said, like, I can't presently, at any rate, for whatever her reasons were, I can't presently carry on at this rate of workload. And I, for my mental health or something, you know, this is me. I have no basis for this. It's just my own feelings about what might have happened. So she maybe was meant to be right through the following season too, but they felt a duty of care towards her, and they said, we want you to still be part of it, so we'll bring you back in a smaller capacity, smaller but just as important capacity next season. And so they probably did have to reshape that ending, but given that that's the case, I still think it was really well done and actually quite well rationalized. You know, I've heard people complain that they believe that her, you know, having found her birth mother and investigating the birth father and all that was too flimsy a reason, in their opinion, for them to have this sort of even temporary separation. But I don't think that's true.
It makes loads of sense. Like, I think absolutely. I think the only thing I personally would have preferred is if it was just like a little, yeah, like you mentioned Sarah leaving, like that sort of just a little more underplayed with like just a moment of you know, him alone in the TARDIS afterwards, rather than it yeah, again, like I said, being played like they're being ripped apart and are never going to see each other again. I know that's the, like, on an emotional level, that's what the Doctor's feeling, because, like, yeah, they're temporarily separated, but he knows that this is like the beginning of the end of, they're not going to be traveling together. So
one other reason I just want to bring in, because this illustrates both something that kind of simultaneously, a scene that both simultaneously annoyed and I both loved it and hated it at the same time, because there's that very quiet scene where Kate comes and finds the Doctor, you know, in one of the little pauses and things in the middle of all the madness, and she says, she's talking to him about how her father would tell stories about the Doctor, you know, in the firelight and all when she was younger, and he says this amazing thing, which I think is very on point for his Doctor in particular, where he says, in those days I was the great enigma, and I'm still trying to shake that off. And I think that's brilliant. That's so him, right? He's all about text and not, he's all about sort of text and not subtext these days. He wants to be straightforward. He wants to be, he, you know, this is progress for him, not to be so, you know, mysterious all the time. Even though he will accuse himself of exactly that in the Christmas special. But at the same time, it really, the one bit I really didn't like in that was he's talking about his granddaughter and saying, oh yeah, I am a granddaughter, but not yet. And I just thought, what? I don't know, that just doesn't.
Yeah, there's been a lot of little skirting around Susan, this, like, in The Devil's Chord as well. Maybe we can talk about that briefly, you know. Mm-hmm. Speculation, see if that will come back. But shall we go on to?
Yes, I think so. I did really ramble on there. Apologies, but I feel like one of the few people that really, you know, thinks that Empire of Death is actually. I'll stop short of saying a masterpiece, but way way better than people are giving it credit. Like many people are giving it credit for. So I probably got a bit carried away there, but.
No, I think it's always better to hear a sort of defense of something that has been, you know, had a mixed reception rather than just rehashing the same tired old criticisms. So, and like I said, I agree with you a lot about like those bits in isolation, like that scene encapsulating the spirit of Doctor Who. I think that's a really, really sort of lovely thought as well. But yeah, let's go on to Joy to the World. I think both of us like this one, and I think a lot of people did as well. I think overall it went down quite well. Viewing figures, like Christmas always means there's a bit of a bump, but I think it did reasonably well in the viewing figures as well. I don't have the numbers to hand. But yeah, I think you especially liked this one. What was it about Joy to the World that really stood out for you?
Okay, yeah, I actually, when I watched this on Christmas Day, I think about 5 minutes after the episode had ended, I realized that it was my favorite Christmas special of all. And I thought, wow, that's a very, you know, normally it takes a little time to make up your mind about that stuff. But I thought that's a very firm conclusion I've drawn quite quickly there. Why is it my favorite? And I think it's a number of things. I think it just... I think it's the one that just destroyed me the most emotionally. Like it just, you know, to bring it back, like what do you want a Christmas episode to do? You don't want it to be overly mawkish, but you want it to resonate deeply with you on an emotional or spiritual level or something. And this did. Now, one criticism I've heard people say quite a lot is that they find it, I don't know whether you will or won't agree with this one, but they find it to be like an uneasy compromise between, in other words, it should, in their opinion, it should have been one thing or the other, either the year spent at the hotel exclusively, or it should have been giving Joy more airtime. How do you feel about that, actually?
I think I said at the time I would have liked more time with Joy. I think it was enough. Like, yeah, it was enough to for that ending to have the impact it was supposed to have. And yeah, so in hindsight, I think it works fine. But yeah, my initial impression was more along those lines of like this felt a bit. And I think part of the sort of confusion with that was like who was being pushed as the big star. And maybe that was like a marketing thing. But both of these actresses were great. But it just seemed weird that only one of them was like getting that top billing when both of them had some really great moments with the Doctor.
I have a little theory about that. But actually, what I want to say before it goes out of my head first is that I actually feel that it was perfectly weighted between those two elements. I think some people are looking at it as this thing that was sort of like had to be was bodged together from parts for behind the scenes reasons, and you can sort of see the join. And to me, instead, it looks like it's been carved out of whole marble the whole time. Like it's a perfect thing, and the exact amount of joy and the exact amount of the year in the hotel was there. That thing works as a short story in the middle perfectly, and any more of it would have overtoppled it. And any less of, I think we just had just the right amount of joy to really get to know her as a person, get some really powerful stuff from her, and then see her, you know, transform into the star, and by then really feel something about that. But the theory thing I was going to get back to was, isn't it interesting that yes, you did have the star, you know, Nicola Coughlan, whose star is very much on the rise, no pun intended. But she, so, and then you have this actress playing Anita. And first of all, Anita, that's an interesting name. I don't know whether that's a bit of a red herring or a teasing of the fans to try and make you make a connection with Mrs. Flood. But it wouldn't surprise me, because if she did turn out to be Mrs. Flood in the end, and it's because they cast an actress there, and if I remember rightly, it was her first television thing ever, and it was supposed to, well, notionally it was supposed to be quite a small 5-minute appearance by her, or you would only have seen the bits you saw at the start with Joy signing in and so on. And we're told the story that actually when they realized what she could do, they wrote up her part more and more. And I'm not sure I believe that. I think that feels like a little bit of a fib. And I think they wrote it exactly as it was from the outset, but they didn't want to pull too much focus towards this lady, but they needed to pull a certain amount of focus to her by giving her this full year in the Doctor's company, because she may well turn out to be Mrs. Flood. And you may think, well, how would that be? Because she's just a very straightforward, normal person. But then she goes to work in the Time Hotel. So let's imagine that maybe she gets, I don't know, possessed by a force. Maybe she becomes the receptacle for one of the guardians or something. You know, I don't know what it is.
Something quite big would have to happen. Because like I said, I was rewatching Empire of Death, and the way that she talks, she's talking about herself as being on the same level as gods, even if she's not a god herself.
It's so interesting, isn't it, that she's talking about tearing down the gates of heaven and stuff like that. Yeah. And we do have hints at hell in the forthcoming season. So there's something going on with heaven and hell there. To return to Joy to the World, yeah, I just find it a perfect emotional journey. I love the fact that at the end, they actually treat the business of the Bethlehem moment with, first of all, I think it's right after all the Christmas specials we've had to finally go there, but also to do it in a way that respects everybody. So whether you're atheist, agnostic, or a firm believer, you can take what you want from that moment. It can hit you on your own emotional level. The iconography of it is still there. Yeah. And the joy of the Doctor in that moment, and just the visuals and the music in particular, I just think it all comes together. That there's a beautiful music cue, that whole final build up to that moment.
It's done very reverently, and like in a way that's not going to upset anyone, but it's also a little bit fun. And it's almost like the sort of the dialogue version of it. Is it the 10th Doctor who drops a hint about being at at the stable, but
oh yeah,
like when you hear him talk about it, that's like much more irreverent in terms of how it's put across. But this was like,
there's a slight flippancy about the no rib at the end at the start, but then I think when you get there, it's done very, very sensitively. And actually, something else you've just reminded me of was another sort of sensitive approaching of that was in the Paul McGann story on audio, the Relative Dimensions, where he talks about Leonardo wanting to go see the nativity and so on, and then they get almost to the inn, and then he has a panic attack and needs to go back, and so he describes that whole thing so beautifully, and then he says, well, he still ended up painting a beautiful picture at the end of it, anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. I didn't really need to go on there. It's a very Stephen Moffat-y thing, you know, to have that. Just, I don't know, he plots it so well, and he has just the right character things said, you know, like there's a character like Trev, you know, he's not in it much, but you really feel for Trev, you know, like he by the end he feels like an old friend, and you're like, yeah, I'm glad you're dead, but you're happy. You know,
yeah, I think Moffat's really good at, I mean, things like The Night of the Doctor is the peak example of that, of like packing a lot in and doing it in a really deft, concise way. I totally agree with you that there's lots of little examples of that here. One that stood out for me, one example of that is the opening scene, which is kind of, I think I talked about this on the sort of immediate reaction episode, but it's kind of going against this thing of like the Doctor being going back to the thing about like the Doctor being this weird Patrick Troughton style character who's popping in to steal milk rather than, you know, being a superhero or some other type of character. It felt like really going back to the weird, strange roots of the character.
Mm, I did love that. Yeah, the milk stealing and the mugs that are bigger on the inside and all that. Just him in his house coat there, like, you know, just... the whole thing's brilliant. Yeah, and there's so much you could say. I know I'm not going to be able to do the thing justice. It's just how it hits me on an emotional level. I think I know I could watch that one again. Oh, I'll tell you what. Sorry, I would be absolutely furious with myself if I hadn't mentioned this part. That moment in the lift, like the part that really captivates me every time. It's uncomfortable to watch, but it is brilliant. And it's almost like the Doctor has to channel his inner Seventh Doctor in that moment or something, because the stakes are so high.
Yeah, I really like that moment.
He is brutal there, you know, and it's like he doesn't hold back. You know, you really, there's no, now you know it's hurting him on the inside to do that, but he gives it, like he goes full method, like he's just going, right, I have to be
and you can't
cruel here, you know, cruel to be kind.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't have that every episode, but I think those sorts of moments are great for actually giving this Doctor some edges and some, because he's extremely like charismatic and likable in every episode he's in. But though, and it's the same with Jodie Whittaker's Doctor as well, actually, like extremely likable and watchable and really feels like the Doctor. But I wanted her to get more moments of that edge and those unexpected turns, and yeah, this, that the moment in the lift that you've described, that worked so well for me because of that.
Yeah, I could watch that over and over again, just because as an acting thing between the two of them, it is immaculate. Every single beat and choice that they make, and it even helps you forget about the fact that lift must be traveling incredibly slowly.
That's a very common TV trope, that like lifts take just as long as you need for the conversation to happen. One more thing to mention about this episode, I think, before we move on, is and you alluded to it earlier, but like all the stuff with Joy's mum, and I don't know if they use the word COVID, but like referring to the pandemic in a pretty obvious way, I thought all of that was like incredibly like really well judged in terms of how far they go and the balance between, you know, being upsetting and like having that moment of happiness at the end, and doing all that in you know, a fluffy piece of Christmas television. And yeah, I thought it walked all those lines really well, and it contrasted, and it was very real. It was like acknowledging that COVID and the pandemic happened, and it's always interesting how TV shows engage or don't engage with those sorts of things. And it contrasted for me with, like, back in 2005, where you have, you know, the reference to weapons of mass destruction, and what was the phrase? Weapons.
Oh, they could be deployed in 45 minutes. Or was it 45 seconds? Sorry.
45 seconds. And it was something like weapons of, it was some variation on that phrase. And that was obviously referring to real world events, but in a much more kind of jokey sci-fi sort of way. Uh-huh. That was still fun and was making some sort of point. And you know, the whole thing about the Tony Blair analog being the Prime Minister. But the way it's handled in Joy to the World, I thought it was like a really emotionally sincere and well-judged version of that in terms of engaging with serious real-world events.
Oh, completely. I mean, and that bit where she just breaks emotionally because she's reliving the trauma of listening to the advice, and she's railing about these politicians that, you know, were total hypocrites and the damage that, you know, it would have been, it's a traumatizing thing anyway, but to have been let down so badly, I think Doctor Who acknowledging that in about as overt a way, or making room for that to the right extent, not underselling it, and not underselling it. I think that's the key thing.
So,
and of course it was very specifically the year 2020 there, you know, so what else could it be except for COVID, even though you're right, yeah. it doesn't explicitly say so. It's an incredibly powerful piece of work. I think it's, and actually just one tiny thing further on Mrs. Flood. Somebody, this is not me now, like some other eagle-eyed person out there had spotted that there's a car in the first Christmas special, Church in Ruby Road. It appears to be the same blue car, supposedly, as Anita's car, and it's outside Mrs. Flood's house or whatever, or nearby, in shot anyway. And of course she has that moment where the car is reprogrammed to take her where she needs to go. It's a bit TARDISified or something. I just wanted to throw that in there because I thought I'm not taking credit for that one, and I can't remember to whom I should give the credit, but I read it somewhere online, someone had spotted that, and I thought it was an interesting catch. Yeah.
Well, let's wrap up then with, like, moving on to season two theories, hopes, fears. We have episode titles. We've got a few trailers now. We've got a behind-the-scenes trailer. Let's do it in terms of, like, hopes and fears. Like, what are you hoping for from season two?
Non-cancellation at the end of it. to be a bit more serious, not that that's not serious, because we have serious worries about that. I would just like to see, in a way, more of the same, but because I think it's been a very strong run, and I could just sit and watch Nshuti and another, you know, another companion who's obviously going to have a great dynamic with him, just foregrounded against whatever events they're going to throw at us. I would, you know, even though I said I'd learned my lesson, I think when we spoke about this last time, I said I'd learned my lesson and I absolutely wasn't going to rekindle the embers of the meta theory. I don't know. Things seem to be...
There's a lot of things lining up, like the episode two is very much along those... Well, that is the concept of episode two, and the name of the final episode is the
reality war. And even in terms of the promotional stuff, they have those little adverts that they put on where the Doctor was popping up in programs, you know, and like an old episode of EastEnders, like a really old episode of EastEnders and stuff like that. And you're kind of going, what's, you know, is that saying something? Because if it's not saying something, it's an odd, that one in particular, the you know the 90s episode of EastEnders is a particularly odd one to have
like
used.
In isolation, you could just see that as like marketing, like an extension of a thing of like having fun with idents and things like we have done in the past, like, you know, David Tennant driving a sled through the BBC ident. Like we've had lots of stuff like that in the past. I think it's the all of this stuff coming together in a cumulative way that starts to rekindle that theory.
And the BBC, not the Disney, but the BBC promotional stuff had at the end, you know, the little those little cool what do you call them? They're like just 2 second things of what each episode's about. You know, little sort of style things. The final one has, you know, like the cracks coming out of the Doctor Who logo and stuff, and it just, if that's not saying Doctor Who will turn out to be a program from which all realities fragment, I don't know what would, you know, but I've been wrong about this before. I'll probably be wrong again, and, you know, Mrs. Flood possibly turn out to be, I don't know, Romana gone bad or something. God knows.
I'm hoping for Mrs. Flood to be some sort of really compelling, interesting new character. I'm sure there's a way of having it be the Rani or someone else that we already know and it being good, but I don't know. I feel like I'm drawn to the idea of her just being some new, fascinating entity that we have no idea about, and even like a bit ambiguous about like who she is or what powers she has, and maybe we don't get all the answers about her by the end of the season. It seems obvious there's going to be some big reveal about her, and we even have hints about like which episode that's going to come with some of the leaks and things. I think Russell T. Davis has like given a warning about which episodes to like really catch up with to avoid leaks.
See it on broadcast or see it on online
was it
or just avoid social media for the rest of the day kind of thing. Episodes three and six
he said. So we know there's going to be big things in each of those episodes. I'd like her to be something new. I would like, because I wasn't as sold on the season one finale. One of my hopes is that seasons one and two work together to tell like a story that's more satisfying for me as a whole.
Here's an interesting thing on that very topic, which is, I forgot to say this when we were talking about the two-part finale just a moment ago. There's a point during the whole investigation of that amazing, beautifully done sequence where they're inside the VHS tape and all that. And Chidozie, is it you call the unit operative that goes on in? You know, the Doctor, you know, encourages him to go on in at his own risk. And of course, the guy gets killed. But at the point when he gets killed, Sutek, well, who we will later find out to have been Sutek, says, the voice from the cloud says, he has gone to hell, right? And then later on, when Kate and everyone else on the planet has died, but then gets resurrected thanks to bringing death to death. By the way, I think death to death is not silly at all. It's beautiful and it's poetic, and I will defend that one to the death. But anyway, people are being sometimes overly literal about this stuff, but like Doctor Who, you know, who knows what the powers of a god are? He's weaponizing he's making the monster fall into his own traps, and he's doing what he's always done there. So anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yes. Kate comes back and she says she remembers echoes of something. And I thought this time around, okay, that connects to what was said about Chidozie having gone to hell. And this forthcoming season, I think it's episode 3, where that word seems to be somewhat associated with that episode. The first time I heard some of the titles leaked, that was originally going to be called 5 Miles Down. And I don't know, hell, we've had that word used in the past in Doctor Who to refer to, for instance, the thing we call it, the first one with the Ood and all that. You know, we had, so, you know, it's probably not a literal one.
My hope is that the two seasons work together as like two acts of the same story, and that the finale at the end of season 2 is going to wrap the whole thing up in some sort of way that feels very satisfying. I'm also really excited about the new companion. There's a lot of parallels to Martha. Like, she's a nurse rather than a medical student, but just in the little bits that we've seen of her in the trailer, I just get like a really
and good Tegan sense. Tegan, Arena, and Barbara, because the whole mission statement is to get her home.
That's exciting as well. Like, this season has like that really strong like mission statement. Like, this is what we're trying to do. Like, it's almost like a movie. Like, you have a sense of what the high level plot is just from that tagline.
Oh, I love that second trailer, by the way, because I would never have guessed in a million years that they'd use a Phil Collins track of all things but it works so well and it ties thematically in so well, because even I'd never heard that song before, but when I went and watched the video, did you do this? In the video, he travels around the world, like he just keeps popping up in all these different landmarks. From Tokyo to Paris. And of course we've even had those little idents where, you know, a destroyed Eiffel Tower is flying through space and all that kind of stuff. So I feel there's something about, you know, there's something really cohesive about this marketing strategy where they're thinking about even the song choice, making it thematically relevant, but maybe subtly thematically relevant for anyone casual looking in. But yeah, I just think it feels kind of, I could be getting my hopes up here beyond what they should be, but it feels very sure-footed in what it's doing. I've almost begun to wonder, is RTD sort of nearly trying to, I know it might just literally be that like Disney really are sitting on their hands and he doesn't know what's going to happen, and there could be a couple of years where they don't even know whether the show's coming back, but I think he might even just be playing a bit of a game. He knows what the plans are, but he can't reveal what they might be until, or the new format for the show or something, until whatever happens.
It's all speculation, but like, I wonder as well whether he's trying to be clever and hedge his bets with where season 2 is going, because if this is some sort of multiverse reality war thing that it's all heading towards, maybe the ending. Oh, and that's the other thing, we've heard about reshoots, haven't we?
Yes,
finale. So
and the reasons for those reshoots as well, the rumored reasons.
Oh well, yeah, that's the other thing about like is the Doctor gonna regenerate, and but in terms of like, is it gonna go on hiatus? Are Disney gonna continue? Is it gonna go back to just being a BBC thing? Is it gonna be a new, maybe this reality war finale has some sort of safety mechanism where they can reboot the show in like various different forms depending on where like the production backstage stuff goes in future. So like, there's some big cliffhanger at the end of this season, and then if Disney continue, we get like more in the same style. But if it goes back to the BBC, maybe we have some sort of reality-changing event that justifies why we're shifting our scope and style back to where it used to be.
Yeah, I think you could be onto something there. That sounds very persuasive. Yeah, so but another thing about that is, say for instance that Inchudi, who very understandably at this point must be thinking, look, I have other things to be doing here. I'm a young up and coming actor, and I can't sit around indefinitely waiting for contracts to be, you know, signed here. What if, that being the case, RTD has said to him, look, hang fire here, we will accommodate you. Like, say we do need to go to just like 2 years of two specials per year or something like that. We can quickly shoot them, we can get them done, we can let you go off into your Hollywood stuff, and we'll still have you. I think that would be a very worthwhile compromise, because he's so good, this guy. Like, we want him for as long. Well, I would certainly, like, I'd take 10 years of Inchudi's Doctor, do you know what I mean? I'd happily see him be the longest running we've had on TV, but you know, realistically, that's not the modern way it goes.
And we've had so little of him, so like, it's sort of, if he stops after this, then he won't have done much more than Christopher Eccleston.
No, that's true. He does say in at the end of Empire of Death, he does say, I'm keeping this face, don't you worry, I'm keeping this face for a long time. Which maybe in retrospect sounds, you know, like that moment that Colin Baker said he was going to do 7 years. But you know,
it could be a time of the Doctor situation where we have a story where he spends thousands of years.
That's true. Yeah. Get the old prosthetics going. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So anything else about season two before we wrap up? I'm just looking through the episode titles to.
Could we have good songs, please, for the Eurovisions?
Oh, yeah, there's a Eurovision episode, which they've managed to sync to the day, I think. And they talked about having, like, backup plans around marketing, I'm presuming, if it didn't align precisely. But I think they managed to have it go out on the day.
Yeah, that was a lucky break.
So we've got Robot Revolution. Lux is the one that... one of the ones I'm most interested in. They all look interesting. Like this whole, from the first trailer, and again, trailers don't always accurately reflect what the actual thing is like, but both the BBC and Disney trailers I've really liked. And the first BBC one had this much kind of scarier atmosphere to it. That felt, I don't know how to describe it, like less safe. Like they were like, okay, we've established what this new era is, who this new Doctor is, now we're going to do. And the 2006, like, series two was a bit like that. You had, you know, the impossible planet, Satan Pit, and I don't think you would have had that sort of story in season one. They needed to establish what this new Doctor Who is and then do those weirder, darker stories on that foundation. And this feels like a repeat of that, of like branching out a bit and doing stuff that's more ambitious, more weird, interesting.
Yeah, I love what's really exciting is there's whole swathes of this season, I think even more so than last time, where you just don't know what, like there's what looks like a sort of a 1960s kind of, I don't know, like a cafe or something that gets tilted sideways at one stage, and it's got very, you know, it's I don't know whether it's African American or what the vibe is there, but there's distinctive flavors to each episode. That Wish episode looks, I don't know, very otherworldly, or you know, something like out of Mervyn Peak or something. It's got that kind of vibe about it. And yeah, I mean, I think Lux is the one that I think could on its face be the most sort of like, okay, Here's our sort of equivalent gimmick to last year's.
There's a pretty much identical scene of them getting dressed.
That's true as well. So there's the speculation about whether that's intentional, isn't there? Because it's so shot for shot the same that it's, some people are going, you know, weaponizing that and going, this is RTD finally out of ideas. And then some people are going, well, hold on, what if this means something? You know, that they're making that so overtly shot for shot the same. I don't know. Actually, just on that subject, and I'll try and make this point as quickly as possible, but it's been on my mind, right? There's been a lot of online negativity about the show from certain quarters, right? And they seem to be attacking on it every front. The primary one being that it's supposedly woke and so on. And I know it's like a case plus a change on that one, right? But the thought struck me the other day. I wondered if you took last season, the season we just spoke about, right? And somehow through some timey-wimey mechanics, you could take that and swap it and put it into 2005 as the first season we had and put 2005 season here, you know, just swap the bookends around completely. The same people would probably be waxing lyrical about what we had in the first year and say that this year is rubbish. And it's not the show that's changed. It's them. They've got older.
I think it's totally the cultural context. It's the same thing with like a lot of anti-trans stuff at the moment. Like you used to have trans people on shows like Big Brother, and it wasn't an issue. It's only like in the recent, you know, last few years where has become a massive issue for people.
For sure. I mean, you've definitely got the transphobes and the racists and so on, but like, let's put them to one side, right? There's still a critical mass, and thankfully not the majority, but a very loud minority that's out there and just Doctor Who is not what it used to be. It's gotten rubbish. The storytellers and this show needs to be cancelled. And they sound angry and bitter. And I think what they're angry and bitter about is, I think this is history repeating, because you remember somewhere around like the early 80s, fandom began to sort of eat its own tail a bit and just get a bit poisonous and call for RTD to be sacked. I think we're sort of there again with the people that came young to the revival and are now, you know, they've 20 years on the clock since then, and life has been maybe a bit unkind to them, and they're just, the show isn't giving them, 100%. The show isn't a sort of an all fixing salve for them. You know, it can only pull them out of their workaday lives for 45 minutes, and then they have to go back. Do you know what I mean? And they just, I think some people just need to try a bit harder to reaccess their inner child and still see that it's hard. The show's heart is still the same, and it's something to still be hugely proud of.
We probably haven't got time to go into it now, but like that's just made me think of something else, which is like, I wonder how much this new show is landing with like children and teenagers. Like who's, I think there've been like some stats and surveys on this. I haven't really looked into them into that much detail, but my instinct or my sense is that it's nowhere near like the impact of 2005, where it like really landed with the audience that it was meant to. And those people, like you say, have stayed with it for a couple of decades.
Although interestingly, I think one of the stats we did hear about, wasn't it, was that, I mean, this may have just been an attempt at spin, you know, pulling the positives out of whatever data points they did have. But it was supposedly the case that for BBC One anyway, Doctor Who is the youngest skewing.
That's true. But then I don't want to be negative, but like the counter argument would be like it doesn't have loads of competition on BBC for like what else is there that's going to compete with it. And maybe that's because like the landscape is not in a great position in terms of like BBC produced sci-fi and fantasy. And again, like a couple of decades ago, Doctor Who seemed to be prompting a bit of a resurgence of that. You know, you had like Merlin and other bits and pieces that were sort of jumping on the excitement that Doctor Who was generating.
Then maybe what we need to hope for here is that instead of it being 1989 all over again, what we've got is 1969. You know that point at which the BBC were sort of going, did we make any more of this? And then they went, can you think of anything that's going to do this better than it's already been done? Give it another run.
I want to look back on when the end of season two is done, or maybe when War Between the Land and the Sea is done as well. And we talked about this in one of our previous episodes, but like going into this new era, I was expecting more like radical reinvention and revolution. I don't know what that looks like. I've no idea what that would be, but I was expecting something with all the talk of it being a new era, I was expecting a bigger departure from what we had before, and I was up for that. I loved like trying something new and different, and it's been more of an evolution rather than that revolution I was hoping or expecting.
And part of that is Russell T. Davis himself, who's brilliant at talking things up, but he can sometimes talk himself up onto a ledge, you know. But what he did was he was saying, look, I'm writing stuff that this show has never, ever attempted before. And I was thinking, wow, what could that
there
be?
Are like,
what's so out of the box here? That, and one of the things that came to mind to me as a concept that they, you know, maybe this is too out there, but I was envisaging things like it's going to start off as a series where, like, there's five people and one of them is the doctor, but they don't know it. And they have to go on a quest and one of them is going to turn out to be the doctor, but, and they know that it's going to be one of them, but they don't yet. You know, do you know what I mean? It could be that sort of thing where you only find out at the end of the season, which of these apparent humans is actually the person who's going to, you know, become or re-become the doctor or something like that. Like that would be a truly revolutionary thing. So that would maybe capture a young demographic in a way that the show never has before.
So this would be like a, we should probably wrap up soon, but that's given me like an idea about a discussion we could have in future. Like maybe when series two is done and we could think, okay, where should Doctor Who go next? Do you remember that Doctor Who magazine article in the Wilderness Years?
I do, with the little Lego people and all in it.
Yes, and what was it called? That Bigger Than Star
Wars? We're going to be bigger than Star Wars, it was called. Yeah.
And it was like all of those like New Adventures authors and people like doing their pitches for what Doctor Who should be. Like,
wasn't Russell T. Davis and actually Stephen Moffat and I think Geddes were in there. Which one of them, I think it was RTD, who said the way he would do it, this was him talking then, and it shows you how much his thoughts evolve on these things over years. But he was talking then about how he would bring it back and call it Doctor Who 2000. And have the doctor work in a bookshop somewhere in a little village. And then over time, mysteries would be brought to his door. And there'd be a little police box parked somewhere on the village green or something that doesn't have any significance until episode six or something. I think that's the sort of stuff he was saying. And then
that's interesting because I think like 2005, we were just at the point where the mill was making like, you know, acceptable CGI within reach. Mm-hmm. So maybe like late 90s, Russell T. Davies wasn't thinking that was on the table. So he was thinking, okay, how do we make Doctor Who effectively in the constraints of BBC budgets? And like you said, 1969, 1970, maybe that sort of thinking was on his mind at that point. Like, mm-hmm. how do we just shift the whole setup of the show to do something cool within those constraints?
But one final thing I just want to say is you mentioned the land between the war and the sea before, and the one thing that gives me hope that, you know, the reality war is not Doctor Who's final television episode for, you know, a decade or something, is that or forever, is that I just don't see the BBC putting out as its final ever thing of the Hooniverse a spin-off about the Sea Devils. I just can't conceive that that's how you bookend things. So there'll be at least one more thing. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic there, but I kind of do trust that RTD, if anyone can work miracles and turn this ship around in terms of the possible decline of popularity and maybe genuinely blindside people with something extraordinary here, I think he's capable of it. I think he's still capable of it.
Yeah. All right, so I think we're both going into season two with like high hopes and some excitement. We're expecting to do like more instant reactions on the podcast as we go through the season. And I think it would be great to get together again afterwards for another retrospective once season two is done. But any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I think that's it for me. We've done that one. We've covered that pretty thoroughly.
I think so. And I think these chats have like helped me to like see the good stuff in season one that I might have missed because of focusing on the bits that I just didn't fall within my expectations or do exactly what I wanted them to. There's so much good stuff for me in the middle of that series that I think really stands up and is worthwhile. So yeah, I've really enjoyed going back over it.
Yeah, me too. I've really enjoyed this.
So we'll leave it there. And yeah, as I said, we'll be back with reactions for season two. Otherwise, thanks very much, Mark, for joining me.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
And we will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.